It was an ordinary Thursday evening, April 4th, 2019. The Meridian Park apartments sit quiet under rows of street lamps, the kind of calm that makes every sound feel louder than it should. But then, around 10 p.m., gunfire. Sharp, rapid, the kind that rips through walls and ends conversations mid-sentence. On the second floor, inside apartment 205, chaos exploded behind a half-open door. A man hit the floor. A woman screamed for it to stop. She ran into the hallway, banging on the only other door nearby, shouting for someone, anyone, to call 911. Then she darted back inside, pleading, crying, trying to shield the man on the floor with her own body. More shots. And when the noise finally stopped, the silence that followed felt even louder. By the time officers reached the top of the stairs, the door stood open. The air was heavy. He was barely breathing. She was bleeding beside him, and the night would never sound the same again. Hello, and welcome to today's episode of Sleuthy Stories. If you're new here, this is the podcast where real-life mysteries unfold, one clue at a time. The audio for today's story has been pulled from my main YouTube channel and remastered for this podcast experience. If you'd like to see the visuals that accompany this case, head over to my YouTube channel, Sleuthy Lucy. But for now, sit back, listen closely, and let's unravel the mystery together. Thanks for being here. Hey there. The story I have for you today, let's just say, sometimes it isn't about who pulled the trigger. It's why she felt she had to walk through that door in the first place. A door that didn't just open. It invited chaos in. We'll get to names later. But for now, picture this. A man who had everything to lose. A woman who had already lost too much. And a relationship that went from, I've got you, to you owe me in record time. It's about something that looked like love until it started coming with conditions, promises blurred into lies, a lifestyle he only pretended to live. And somewhere in that mess is a woman who showed up searching for closure and found catastrophe instead. All right, here's how it all went down. That chaos you just heard? It didn't start there. It started long before, with choices, secrets, and a door that never should have been opened. Collierville, Tennessee. Just outside Memphis. Far enough to feel removed from the noise, close enough to still hear its echo. Tree-lined streets. Perfect lampposts. A best places to live kind of town. Where neighbors wave, lawns stay trimmed, and chaos feels like someone else's problem. The Meridian Park apartments fit right in. Gated, modern, tucked into quiet cul-de-sacs with names like Whispering Pines and Summer Trace. Balconies overlooking clean parking lots, late model cars still shining after sunset. Safe, predictable, until it wasn't. Because inside one of those second-floor units, that picture-perfect calm had already started to crack. And the couple who'd just moved in, the ones everyone saw smiling at the mailboxes, were carrying something that didn't fit the neighborhood at all. Secrets, resentment, and a version of love that came with consequences. Even in a town built on appearances, you can only hide the truth for so long. And by that spring, it was already following them home. The first 911 call came in just after 10 p.m. Gunshots, screaming, second floor. Officers were already nearby when another call followed, a neighbor reporting multiple shots inside building 1681 at the Meridian Park Apartments. When patrol cars turned through the main gate, a neighbor stood waiting, holding it open to speed them through. They pointed toward Building 1681, the second floor walkway. "Up there! It's up there!" Officers moved in, weapons drawn. As they climbed the stairwell, the night's calm shifted into something else. That charged silence when officers realized the danger isn't over. Then they froze. Through the open door of apartment 205, a man was down in the doorway, bleeding heavily. Items were scattered. A hallway rug shoved out of place. Blood smeared across it, the wooden floor streaked along the walls. And inside the kitchen, just a few feet away, the shooter was still standing, gun in hand, completely still. Before medics could enter, officers had to secure the scene. They called out commands, urgent, but controlled. "Put the gun down." No response. She wasn't looking at them, wasn't looking at anything. Her lips were moving, but the words were only for herself. "Ma'am, put the gun down." Nothing. Then suddenly, she dropped to her knees, gun still in her hand, still mumbling, still detached from everything unfolding around her. Then she lifted it to her head, her mouth, her chest. The officers could see exactly where this was headed. They called for a less lethal round, a beanbag-style projectile meant to incapacitate without killing, but the launcher jammed. One officer sprinted back to the cruiser for another. Seconds felt like hours. She still wouldn't respond, still whispering to herself, still gripping the gun, and then a single pop. A less lethal round fired, striking her in the chest. She fell, the gun skidding across the floor. Officers rushed in, secured the weapon, cuffed the shooter, and cleared the way for medics. The man in the doorway was barely hanging on. His wife was wounded beside him, but conscious. The shooter, alive, in custody. Chaos had erupted inside one apartment, and now the scene was frozen in place. And within hours, the names behind those doors would make headlines across Tennessee. When officers finally cleared the scene, both victims were rushed to the hospital. Tabitha Perry had been shot once, a single bullet through her shoulder. She was treated and released that night, but she never left Brodus's side. He wasn't as lucky. Multiple gunshot wounds to the head and abdomen. Doctors rushed him into surgery, but hours later, he was gone. That night marked the end. But to understand how it all began, we have to go back 2 years earlier, to February 2017, the month of love, their anniversary month. And as it turned out, the beginning of the end. So who were Brodus and Tabitha Perry? A young couple who'd built their lives around faith, community, and each other. They'd dated for a year before marrying, both calling Jacksonville home before life eventually led them to Little Rock, Arkansas. Their marriage wasn't perfect, but it was steady. Church, work, and shared devotion. When they arrived in Little Rock, they found their spiritual home at St. Mark Baptist Church, a massive congregation of more than 6,000 members, the kind of church that felt like a small town, ministries for every stage of life, and a calendar that never slept. For Brodus, it wasn't just where he worshiped, it was where he worked. At 34, he was a pastor, responsible for onboarding new members and supervising life groups, small circles of 8 to 10 people who met for study, support, and community. He coordinated meetings, guided leaders, and offered one-on-one counseling when members were struggling. Church wasn't just his job, it was his identity, the place he fed himself spiritually, financially, and socially. His friendships, his travel, even his downtime, cigars, bourbon, late-night book discussions, always looped back to the congregation. As Tabitha once put it, "To know Brodus is to know he's very much a nerd, always with his head in a book, always preparing for the next lesson plan. But she also admitted his leadership style wasn't easy. Abrasive, curt, sometimes rude, especially toward the people he supervised. She never understood how they put up with it, but somehow they did. By late 2018, Brodus was moving up in the ministry world. He'd been offered a new position at one of Tennessee's most prestigious churches, Mississippi Boulevard Christian Church in Memphis. Known simply as the Boulevard, the church carried a legacy. The first African-American congregation founded in the city, and the same place that later hosted Tyree Nichols' funeral. For Brodus, this was a milestone. News spread through St. Mark, and in October 2018, the congregation celebrated him. Despite his often blunt way of communicating, one of his life group leaders, Latasha Daniels, had grown to respect him. She admired his drive, trusted his leadership, and wanted to honor the next step in his journey. So she took the lead in organizing not one, but two farewell gatherings, one at the church and one in a more relaxed setting. Before the move, the Perrys shared their new address with close friends and church members, apartment 205 at Meridian Park in Collierville. By November 2018, they were settled in. A new city, a new church, a new chapter. But 6 months later, that same apartment, the one they'd been so proud to call home, would become the scene of Brodus Perry's death. After hours of surgery and life-saving efforts, Brodus was pronounced dead the night of April 4th, 2019. Tabitha received the news no spouse is ever prepared for, and by morning, deep in shock and grief, she faced something she never expected. Police questions about the horror she'd survived. She was alone in a new city, with family hours away, and no way to reach anyone from the church. Every contact was saved in Brodus's phone, and she didn't know the passcode. So first responders stepped in. They contacted Pastor Jason Turner of the Boulevard, who then reached out to Pastor Philip Pointer from St. Mark in Little Rock. By morning, Pastor Turner and his wife were by Tabitha's side, and Pastor Pointer had driven in from Arkansas. When Tabitha arrived for questioning, both pastors sat beside her as detectives began the interview. She started at the beginning. Around 9:30 p.m., she'd been on the couch with her dog, Anakin, watching TV when she heard a faint knock. Another knock followed, louder this time, so she checked the door. The peephole was covered. Thinking it was Brodus playing around, she called out, "I'm not opening the door if I can't see you," then sat back down. A third knock came. This time, she saw it, locks of hair swinging. "Tasha, is that you?" The woman nodded. Tabitha put the dog away and opened the door. It was Latasha Daniels, a familiar face from their church in Little Rock. Odd, considering Little Rock was more than 2 hours away, but the Perrys had shared their new address widely, and she and Tasha had grown friendly in their last months at St. Mark. Tennis, group outings, dance classes. When detectives asked if she questioned the visit, Tabitha said yes. Tasha told her she was in town for a conference. Tabitha invited her in. They made small talk, kids, life, tennis. Before long, Tabitha called Brodus to ask when he was coming home. She knew he usually stopped at his favorite cigar lounge after work and needed to drop something off with Pastor Turner. She told him she had a surprise waiting. About 20 minutes later, he walked through the door. When he saw Tasha, he didn't look surprised. "Surprise?" Tabitha said. "This isn't a surprise," he replied. "I thought you had keto cookies for me." He seemed agitated. He asked Tasha why she was there. She repeated the conference story. They chatted a bit. He offered her bourbon. Tabitha declined. She'd had champagne earlier. Then the tone shifted. Brodus began pressing Tasha. Where was she staying? Why was she really there? Soon, he stopped addressing Tasha altogether and focused on Tabitha. The room grew awkward. About 10 minutes later, Tasha stood up. "I'm not going to keep you guys. I'm going to head out." They all walked toward the door. Tabitha first, then Tasha, then Brodus. Tabitha stepped outside, reminding Tasha to drive safely. When she turned back, no one was behind her. Brodus was still in the doorway. Tasha stood just outside, facing him. And then everything collapsed. Tabitha saw Tasha reach into her pocket, pull out a gun, and fire. Multiple shots. Brodus hit the floor. Tabitha screamed and ran toward him, but Tasha told her to back off. She sprinted to her neighbor's door, banging, begging for someone to call 911, then ran back inside. Tasha was in the kitchen, reloading. Tabitha pleaded, "Why are you doing this? Please stop." She dropped to the floor, covering Brodus's head with her body. Tasha told her to move. When she didn't, Tasha shot her in the shoulder. Crying, Tabitha begged her to leave. "I won't tell them it was you," she promised. But Tasha stayed, standing in the kitchen, gun in hand, whispering to herself, "What have I done?" By the time officers arrived, both Tabitha and Brodus were on the floor. Tasha still had the gun, her eyes empty. The door was open. Officers reached the landing and shouted commands. She didn't respond, only whispered. Then she dropped to her knees. She raised the gun to her head, her mouth, her chest. Officers pleaded with her to stop. She didn't. A round was fired. It struck her in the chest. She fell, and officers rushed in to secure the weapon and take her down. As the interview wrapped up, detectives asked Tabitha one final question. "Why? Do you have any idea why she would do this?" Tabitha said Tasha was someone they knew from church, someone they were friendly with. She had no idea why, but she remembered one thing. One sentence screamed over the gunfire. "You broke my heart." Throughout the entire interrogation, Pastors Pointer and Turner sat beside her, quiet as church mice. Shortly after her arrest, Latasha Daniels was indicted on multiple charges: first-degree murder, attempted first-degree murder, second-degree murder, attempted second-degree murder, reckless endangerment, and use of a firearm during a felony. She pled not guilty. Speculation spread immediately, but detectives didn't have to wait long for answers. About a week later, they got a call from a woman named Chriselle. She said she had videos detectives needed to see, recordings from a Marco Polo group she and Brodus participated in. She sent everything to the lead detective. And once they pressed play, the truth began to crystallize. Brodus Perry had been living a double life. That book club he told Tabitha about? It revolved around a single book, one focused on ethical non-monogamy.
For me, our agreements have been simple, right? No exes, nobody from Jacksonville, Florida, which is home for us, and nobody in the 60 that you live in, that currently live in, which means you ain't in Memphis. That was a case, of course, in Little Rock, outside of girlfriend, because girlfriend is in Little Rock. The way that kind of happened is, short version, when she decided to open up the marriage and allow me to be open inside her. Girlfriend is a therapist, right? And she didn't go to her for therapy, but she asked us some questions. And based on this therapy session she had with this other lady, and she was asking her some questions after she had just said, "Bro, is this what I'm gonna let you do? Bother, you know, it is what it is." But from there, she asked her some questions. And so she was like, "I've got a couple questions for you." And, you know, they were gonna play tennis together. She was one of the life leaders. And so we had rapport, we had rapport. And she asked a question and was like, "Yeah, blase, I'm thinking about this. And what do you think about this? Or what do you think X, Y, and Z could potentially become?" And I I'm sorry, I'm looking to see who's in the cigar lounge because this is not allowed to be free there. So yeah, I'm kind of careful about who potentially is in here because I don't want the glass all bounced. You know, I really want to go in and go to Shield in the back, but I'm not a member. So the next thing that she shared with her was, you know my husband like you, right? Well, he thinks you're attractive. And she's like, what? He's like, yeah, I know what he likes. And he thinks you're attractive. Not that he's been rude or anything like that. We've had conversations. Well, you know, we did. Because, like, one time he was sitting around having a watch. And she asked me, I was like, well, you got to get it. I ain't going to get it. I'm coming across this, like, this creepy guy, right? We try to spice things up. And in that regard, even though that was even somewhat limited with the idea of somebody watching and things, I have been thinking about the past couple of weeks in terms of expanding, you know, my ethical non-monogamy. It's kind of, so my wife, you know, her and I, we were chatting the day, I was like, well, babe, I got a couple of questions, I'm just curious, you know. Like, when do you want to know that there's someone who has my interest, there's someone who I would like to pursue? I didn't want to know the moment that I feel like it's more than just banter. Do you want to know at the moment that I would like to begin to banter? Do you want to know once I feel like it might be a thing beyond banter? Or what? You know, because this is kind of new for us, right? Because, you know, girlfriend, Tasha, that's easy. That's been 2 years. That's been it for the most part. Outside of me going, that's out of my birthday. But it's kind of been easy in that regard. So you try to figure out what does that look like. So I was kind of really thinking through where I am with that, right? You know, where in terms of those. So there's a lot of newness. And I said that just to say that there's still a lot of newness even in this ethical non-monogamy that I'm messing with. And it's fun, right? It's fun. It's interesting. It's causing us to communicate and chat and really talk again about different things that we've kind of, in a real sense, have been settled to some degree. But realizing that in this ethical non-monogamy, we got to keep things in pencil and not pen. You know, some things are in pencil, pen, right? There's some hard news, but gotta be in touch with what that looks like. So that's why I know you're somebody being sprung and giddy and all that stuff. I think because that those flutters of those emotions, right, of those initial thoughts are all kind of new and very much new because this person is brand new. Like, I don't know Sheree, right? I knew Tasha. That was different. There was some level of familiarity there. And that's typically how I've always engaged with it, right? With some level of familiarity. I cannot, whether being in the same class again, in terms of college or something like that, I've never kind of quote unquote cold called anyone. You know, if that makes sense. Because I don't think I'm that guy.
In clip after clip, Brodus talked about his supposed open marriage arrangement, how Tabitha was on board, how she had rules, no exes, no one in Memphis.
We're close. When we were in Little Rock, she lives in Little Rock, so we're out there in Memphis now. I mean, it's only 2 hours away, but yes, we were in Little Rock, so we were literally, that because it was at that point, you know, wife was like, yeah, nobody at home. Like, this is an exception, because I kind of threw you that, but no, you ain't dealing with nobody at home. Like, that was Jacksonville, so our heart knows that no Jacksonville, which is hometown for us, no exes, and no place in your current city. Those are the hard no's, right? She got an exception because it was there that she realized, well, yeah, I don't think I want him to be dealing with all these people, all these women, and no doubt these women would be in the church because that's all we do is kind of hang around or in the community or close enough. So it was kind of one of those things.
He talked about wanting to expand the lifestyle beyond his wife and a therapist girlfriend of 2 years. When detectives told Tabitha that, she was stunned. She knew nothing about any such arrangement. Yes, he once asked her to read the book, but she never did. She wasn't interested. To her, every bit of it was a hard no. And that therapist girlfriend? That would be none other than Latasha Daniels. For Tabitha, the revelation hit like a second loss. grieving her husband while realizing she'd never confront the man behind the betrayal, the man she thought she knew. It would take 6 years and countless court delays before she learned the full depth of his lies. 6 years, the same span of time she'd spent tangled in his world. But during trial, she finally saw it with her own eyes, from his own mouth. Every secret, every deception, everything laid bare. The mask came off, and the real Brodus Perry was revealed. He was a liar, a convincing one. And while he didn't deserve to die for what he did, Latasha didn't deserve what he did to her either. When the case finally went to trial in November 2025, the prosecution didn't lean on theatrics. Their story was bare bones, but effective. They walked the jury through a simple, chilling sequence of choices. Surveillance footage showed Latasha Daniels driving from Little Rock to Sherwood, Arkansas, where she stopped at Thompson Sporting Goods. Cameras captured her purchasing a handgun and ammunition. They had the receipt to back it up. From there, her phone records traced the drive from Little Rock to Collierville, more than 2 hours on the road, plenty of time to turn around. She never did. Instead, prosecutors said she went to the Perry's apartment, made small talk with Tabitha, waited for Brodus to come home, and then opened fire. The defense's story took a very different tone, more layered, more emotional. They painted Tasha as a woman in crisis, slowly unraveling under years of psychological strain, a respected therapist who'd helped others manage their emotions, yet silently battled her own, compounded by heartbreak, manipulation, and betrayal, not just from one man, but from every man who'd ever claimed to love her. To them, this wasn't cold-blooded premeditation. It was the collapse of someone who finally broke under the weight of it all. Latasha took the stand in her own defense. She said she and Brodus first connected when she became one of the life group leaders he supervised. At the time, she was running a private practice in Little Rock, a licensed clinical social worker since 2012, specializing in anger management and domestic violence. On paper, she helped others manage anger, stress, communication. Privately, she was falling apart. By February 2017, she was nearing the end of her second marriage. Emotionally, spiritually, culturally, the weight was crushing. She'd grown up in a deeply religious family. Her stepfather was an ordained minister, a man who preached discipline in public, but behind closed doors, was violent toward her mother. And in households like that, the rules weren't written. They were expected. No babies outside marriage. No divorces. No public failures. Tasha had already broken two of those rules. At 17, she got pregnant. Her stepfather insisted she marry the baby's father, Rodney. 4 years later, while she was sitting in a college class, Rodney packed her belongings, rented a U-Haul, and shipped everything back to her parents' house. No warning. No goodbye. When she told her stepfather about the divorce, he threatened to get a lawyer and take her children away. It was the kind of ending that rewires you, leaving her humiliated, unwanted, defective. Still, she rebuilt. She finished college, got her degree, remarried. Her second husband, Brian, brought stability, but not connection. 8 years in, she said she felt invisible again, alienated, starved for affection. Being a therapist made it worse. She couldn't unpack this with colleagues without becoming office gossip, and it wasn't just embarrassment. If anyone knew how deeply she was struggling, it could jeopardize her ability to practice. Ethically, she'd have to step back from clients, and in private practice, that meant losing income her family depended on. So when the weight became too much, she did what she'd been raised to do. She went to the church. That's when she reached out to Pastor Brodus Perry. She knew him. She trusted him. Not just as a pastor, but as someone who seemed to understand the tension between image and reality, who people think you are versus who you really are. In hindsight, Pastor Brodus might have understood those tensions a little too well. He agreed to meet her privately, not at church where people might ask questions, but at her office, a space where she felt free from scrutiny and safe enough to be vulnerable. And in that one decision, two people who were used to guiding others, both hiding their own fractures, set a connection in motion that would change everything. Because what started as spiritual counseling was about to cross every boundary it was meant to protect. Tasha testified that when she first reached out, she told him her marriage was failing. Her self-esteem was at an all-time low. She was emotionally drained, stuck in one of the darkest seasons of her life, even having thoughts of doing things she knew she shouldn't. She needed spiritual direction, guidance, someone who wouldn't judge her. They met for the first session at her office. For nearly 2 hours, she poured her heart out. What was missing in her marriage? What she hoped could be repaired? When it ended, she felt lighter, relieved, like she'd finally found a safe space to breathe. A few weeks later, she scheduled another session. Same office, same setup. But this time, she wanted to address something that had bothered her from the start. In that first meeting, he'd kept both hands buried in his coat pockets the entire time. At the time, she let it go. She was too focused on her pain. Now, with him more relaxed, she finally asked, "What was that about? Keeping your hands in your pockets the whole time?" His answer changed everything. He told her it was because he was trying to maintain his professionalism. Then he clarified what that really meant, that he was attracted to her. Pastor Brodus wasn't there to help, he was there to help himself. Even with that awkwardness hanging in the air, the session continued. She talked again about her marriage, how emotionally unavailable her husband was, how unwanted and unseen she felt. That's when, according to Tasha, Brodus reached out, grabbed the arms of her chair, pulled her closer, and kissed her. In that moment, with that single action, he became everything she just told him her husband wasn't, everything she'd been missing. A space that was supposed to be safe became something else entirely. And in that session, for the first time, things turned physical. He was married. She was married. And of all months, it was February, the month of his wedding anniversary. They both understood the weight. But in that moment, it didn't matter. For Tasha, it felt like finally being seen, emotionally and physically. She said she didn't really know his wife, had only seen her around church. And she didn't think about her much either. She was too caught up in what he was giving her. That one encounter grew into more stolen moments. Soon they were running, cycling, swimming together. Then what started as stolen time became routine. They began appearing in public spaces, cigar lounges, restaurants, church events. Cigars and bourbon became their thing. They'd go to a lounge in Little Rock where he had a locker. He'd pick out cigars. They'd sip bourbon and talk flavor notes like connoisseurs. Whenever they went out, they made sure to bring a third person from church, a built-in buffer. According to Tasha, that person never knew they were there as cover. Then came the travel. Savannah, Israel. He even invited her to Cuba, sometimes for church, sometimes for him. And with the travel came rules. After their first encounter, he had her download Confide, a messaging app where texts vanish as soon as you lift your finger from the screen. No saving, no screenshots, no receipts. From then on, he required all communication on Confide. If they crossed paths in public, she was never to speak first. "You never know who I'm with," he'd say. When they traveled, she was expected to pay her own way. He'd cover the hotel, and inside that room, the rules were his. Breaking one meant losing affection. And then there was the rule that overshadowed all the others. If anything ever went wrong, a medical emergency, an accident, She was never to call 911. Her only call, he said, should be to Pastor Philip Poynter, the senior pastor at St. Mark, known to everyone as P, or the professor. According to the defense, this was the same Pastor Poynter who sat quietly beside Tabitha during her interrogation, saying nothing when detectives asked why Tasha might do such a thing. According to Tasha, he knew about the relationship. They had often spent time with him socially.
Before I can say a word, she hits me with, "I'm sorry." I'm like, "Sorry for what?" So then she goes into the whole, "I apologize for breaching your trust, breaching your confidence by telling you, Pete, my boss, my former boss before, about the situation." Her reasoning was that she felt like if, like you all said, if he could appeal to my quote-unquote greater senses, that I would realize the mistake that I would be making by losing such a wonderful woman. She also apologized. I said that she apologized to Tabitha when Tabitha talked. She told me that Tabitha told her that their conversation was their conversation until she revealed it, so she was not going to talk about the contents with which what they discussed. She basically said, "I feel like I know what you're going to tell me." And at this
point, whenever Brodus traveled to Savannah with Pastor Poynter, she went too. But when the questions came, when detectives wanted to know why this happened, the defense noted what mattered most. He said nothing. The man who wasn't silent was Brodus. Tasha testified it was his voice pushing her to finalize her divorce. He'd dangle it like a condition. "We can't do this or that until you're divorced." By December 2017, the same year their affair began, her divorce from Brian was final. She also said Brodus brought up ethical non-monogamy with her directly, asking her to read the same book he'd discussed in those Marco Polo clips. She did. He told her that Tabitha had given him permission to be open on his side of the marriage, but that she wasn't allowed to do the same on hers. Tasha said she wasn't interested in that kind of arrangement, but he kept pushing it. He started referring to Tabitha and Tasha as sister wives. Then came another layer, him describing her role as a watcher, insisting Tabitha might be on board. "Just give it time." His requests escalated, especially after he joined what he called his book club. He became persistent, asking her to find someone who'd watch. When she finally did, that person was so disturbed by his follow-up requests that she backed out immediately. From there, Tasha said, the relationship began to feel transactional. When a new job opportunity came up, she encouraged him to take it, partly because he was already in trouble at St. Mark. He'd misused a church credit card for about $2,500 and wanted her to cover it. She raised $2,300, and he was still angry it wasn't enough. When it was time for him and Tabitha to relocate, he asked Tasha to help seed the move financially. She raised that money too. She said she did whatever it took to keep him happy. But his behavior shifted. He'd give affection, then withhold it, insist she address him as "yes, sir," and "no, sir." He stopped sharing his schedule, shut her out unless she complied. Then came March 15th, a few weeks before the shooting. They met at a hotel. Something shifted during that hotel visit, sharply, unmistakably. The way he treated her felt different, distant, mechanical, almost transactional. She said it was the first time she felt less like a partner and more like an object, there to serve a purpose, nothing more. She left feeling used, discarded. He left the next morning without saying a word about his plans, a break from their usual routine. Later that day, overwhelmed and spiraling, she said she grabbed her gun, threatening to hurt herself in front of him so he'd finally understand the pain she was in. He calmed her down and took the gun with him. She later learned he hid it in his locker at the cigar lounge. After that, Tasha said she needed space. She stayed with a therapist friend in Pine Bluff, not for treatment, but for refuge, somewhere with a spare room and a person nearby if things got bad. When she came back to Little Rock, they started talking again. Then came April 4th, the day everything unraveled. She testified that she sent their usual good morning text on Confide, but he didn't respond. Hours passed before a message finally came through. When she opened it, all it said was, "I think our time is up." She said she felt angry, humiliated, discarded via a message designed to vanish. "Who does that to someone they say they love?" she asked the court. By mid-afternoon, she was spiraling. Around 3:14 p.m., she opened her phone and wrote a goodbye message to her family, one she knew her younger sister, who helped manage her clients, would eventually find. It was long and emotional, apologizing to her loved ones, her children, explaining the pain she'd carried since February 24, 2017, the day she and Brodus crossed the line. She wrote that she'd tried, but things kept getting worse. She thanked her mother, asked her sons not to be ashamed, admitted she was tired of pretending. She ended it by saying she wanted to be cremated. She had no insurance. After that, she drove to Sherwood to buy a gun and ammunition, because the one she'd had was now in his locker. Surveillance at Thompson Sporting Goods captured the purchase. She already had a destination in mind: Johnson Park in Jacksonville, Arkansas. Jacksonville tied to Brodus, the place he called home. Johnson to her second ex-husband. And the park sat on Ray Road, her stepfather's middle name. To her, it symbolized all the men who'd hurt her. After leaving the store, she stopped at an ATM, went home to leave money in her son's room, changed clothes, slipped the gun and bullets into her coat pocket, and left again. She loaded the weapon in her car. She didn't want her son walking in on her. Her plan, she said, was to drive to the park. But once she got on the interstate, she saw the exit for Memphis and thought, "Go talk to him, Tasha. Let him see you." So she turned toward Memphis, determined to confront him face to face instead of through a disappearing text. While she was driving, he messaged her saying he still loved her. She said it only added confusion. When she arrived in Memphis, she went downtown to an area known as the Pocket, where she knew he spent Thursday nights at a cigar lounge. She circled for parking, then spotted him coming out. Following his rules, she walked past him, saying nothing. But this time, he spoke first. "So, you're just going to walk past me and not say anything?" They talked, and, according to her, came to an agreement. He needed to drop something at Pastor Jason Turner's house, so he told her to go to the apartment first, make small talk with Tabitha about tennis until he got there. If Tabitha asked, she was to say she was in town for a conference. Once he arrived, she said, the plan was to tell Tabitha everything. If Tabitha agreed to a sister-wife arrangement, they'd start fresh. If not, he and Tasha would take one last trip to Kentucky and end it. After leaving the lounge, she put the Collierville address into her GPS. She'd never been there before. She remembered arriving around 9 p.m., sitting in her car, calling him to say she was nervous and having second thoughts. According to Tasha, he told her, "No, we're going. We're going to talk to her." So she got out, slipped on her coat, and walked up to the door, nervous, hopeful, convinced she was finally going to get some closure. She knocked, but Tabitha didn't open it right away. Tasha said she heard her voice through the door. She knocked again. This time, Tabitha opened the door and let her in. They sat on the couch, making small talk. Tabitha even called Brodus, telling him she had a surprise waiting for him. When he walked in, he didn't look surprised, which made sense to Tasha. They'd just seen each other at the lounge. Still, the energy shifted. He asked, "What are you doing here?" She answered the way they'd rehearsed, "I'm in town for a conference." He sat near her and offered her a drink. Bourbon. she accepted. Then came the comment that threw her, "Well, I think you're going to have to stay the night." At first, she thought he was easing into the conversation they'd planned. The talk about telling Tabitha, but he never met her eyes. Instead, she said, he kept circling the surface, talking about cleaning out the other bedroom for her, but never getting to the truth. Then he went completely off script. He started asking where she was staying in Memphis. She panicked a little. She didn't know the area, and he knew that. So she blurted out, "An Airbnb." When Tabitha asked where, Tasha said, "Downtown." And that line of questioning just stopped. But the real conversation, the one she thought she'd driven there for, never came. No sister-wife talk. No plan. Nothing. Tasha told the court she began to feel foolish, like she'd been lured there under false pretenses. He avoided eye contact, and to her, it felt like he'd already changed his mind. He just hadn't said it out loud. So she said she was leaving. They walked toward the door, Tabitha first, then Tasha, then Brodus. Tabitha reminded her to drive safely, not to speed. Tasha said she asked Brodus to walk her to her car. He told her no. She remembered responding, "Why not, sir? That's just Southern hospitality. You walk a woman out when it's dark." She told the jury she just wanted a moment alone with him, to ask why he hadn't followed through. Then, she said, she reached into her pocket for her keys, and the next thing she remembers, she was standing in the kitchen. She admitted firing the gun that struck them both, but insisted she never meant to hurt anyone, that the moment itself was a blur of fear, heartbreak, and missing pieces.
So Tabitha opened the door and was walking out. I was still trying to get him to walk me out. And as I reached into my pockets to get my keys, I remember being outside the door, and then the next thing, I was standing in their kitchen.
Do you deny that you shot Brodus Perry?
I do not.
Do you deny that you shot Tabitha?
I don't, but I know it wasn't intentional.
Did you mean to shoot Tabitha?
No, I wasn't trying to hurt anybody.
When you went to that apartment that day, did you intend to use your gun on either Brodus or Tabitha?
No.
When you went there, what was your purpose in going there?
Thinking that I was going to get some kind of ending to the relationship.
And what do you mean?
Like, okay, of course, after I got to, you know, talking to him at the lounge, we had a plan. It was either going to be a start or an ending, but it was something that I could see, like I knew. It wasn't just a disappearing text, but still, I love you, you know. So I went to the apartment, I guess, for lack of a better word, to get some resolve.
Did you have hope, given that Tabitha was open to the open marriage?
I was nervous about that because, like I said, he had told me she had these rules about not nobody that you know and things like that. So I'm like, she knows me. So I don't know what that was going to be like. I didn't even think about anything beyond that.
As far as Tabitha goes, this is a person that you became friendly with, right?
Correct.
How did you balance that with having an affair with her husband?
It was very hard. We started off, she had approached me to invite me to lunch. It came out of nowhere, and I didn't know like what was really going on, because by this time, Brodus had been talking about us being sister wives. And so when she asked me, I was a little confused because I'm like, okay, you know, has he talked to her about it? But she never said anything about our relationship. Even when we began to play tennis, it was her who initiated it. So it was uncomfortable for me, but we were friendly. And it was hard, but I still did it because I wasn't going to tell her, because I love Brodus.
When Brodus told you that he wouldn't walk you outside, he said, Tab will do it. How did that make you feel?
Rejected. Unworthy. Stupid. I was so stupid. And it hurt so bad.
Were you angry or were you hurt?
I was hurt.
Were you thinking clearly when you pulled the trigger?
No.
Were you reacting to that situation?
Yes.
Was that a traumatic situation for you too, in retrospect?
Oh, yes. I hate what happened. I'm so very sorry. I never wanted to hurt anybody. I've spent most of my life helping. I never would intentionally try to hurt anybody.
Did you ever plan to kill Brodus Perry?
Never.
When you drove to Memphis, were you driving to Memphis to kill Brodus Perry?
No.
Why did you drive to Memphis?
I drove because I just wanted to see him.
Why?
I wanted him to explain why he did that.
Did you hope he would say, we can be together?
Yes.
Did he give you that hope when you went to the apartment?
He did.
Did he yank that hope away?
He did. As he often did.
Did you break in that moment?
I shattered.
Everything that followed, the prosecution and defense would never agree on. But there was one thing nobody disputed. She brought the gun, she pulled the trigger, and two lives, plus her own, were changed forever. In the end, the evidence told its own story. Latasha Daniels admitted to pulling the trigger, but even without her words, the proof was everywhere. Surveillance video from Thompson Sporting Goods in Sherwood showed her at the counter at 4:37 p.m., buying a handgun and ammunition. Detectives recovered the receipt. Ballistics confirmed the bullets used in the shooting matched the same make and caliber she'd purchased just hours earlier. Her phone records traced her entire drive from Little Rock to Collierville, more than 2 hours of road, and plenty of time to turn around. She never did. And detectives even located her original gun, the one Brodus had taken, inside his locker at the cigar lounge. But when the case finally reached a jury, this wasn't a question of who did it. It was a question of why. The prosecution called it premeditated, a calculated act fueled by jealousy and rejection. The defense painted a different picture. A respected therapist who'd been emotionally worn down, manipulated and discarded by the man she trusted most. And when Latasha took the stand, the courtroom didn't see a mastermind. They saw a woman unraveling in real time. She cried. She read the goodbye letter she'd written that afternoon. She spoke about spending years helping others manage pain she'd never fully healed in herself. Maybe it was that contradiction, the helper who couldn't save herself, that reached them, because when the verdict came down, it wasn't the outcome prosecutors had expected. Latasha Daniels was found guilty of the lesser charges, second-degree murder, attempted second-degree murder, and reckless endangerment. She was acquitted of first-degree murder, attempted first-degree murder, and use of a firearm during a felony. The difference? Life with the possibility of parole. It wasn't the outcome the defense fought for. They wanted manslaughter. But in the world of criminal court, where mercy can be rare and nuance even rarer, it was more grace than most defendants ever receive. Because while the evidence proved what she did, the jury couldn't ignore why. Brodus Perry wanted attention. He wanted power, admiration, and the illusion of being desired by everyone who looked up to him. But in chasing that power, he abused the one thing a pastor is called to protect, trust. He could preach integrity on Sunday and violate it by nightfall. And the irony? The same charisma that drew people to him is what ultimately destroyed him. He told Latasha he could manage a double life, that his wife knew, that she agreed, that this was love reimagined. But that lie was the match. And once it was lit, it burned through three lives, his, Tabitha's, and Latasha's. He wanted devotion without accountability. She wanted love without shame. Both were chasing something impossible, because love built on deceit always collapses. It's never a matter of if, only when. The truth is, Latasha could have walked away. She had the degrees, the respect, the means to rebuild. But instead of protecting her peace, she tried to reclaim it from the man who stole it, a man who dangled affection like a reward for obedience. And in doing so, she became everything she never imagined, the one people needed protection from. He lied to keep control and to conceal desires that could never coexist with the life he preached. Behind the sermons, behind the books and the bourbon, was a man addicted, full stop. Addicted to image, addicted to affirmation, addicted to his impulses. She killed trying to get it back, the love, the validation, the truth she thought she was owed. And in the end, both lost everything. Their reputations, their futures, their humanity. Because love, real love, doesn't demand secrecy, obedience, or sacrifice at the expense of your sanity. It's not supposed to break you just to prove it's real. That's the story of Pastor Brodus Perry and Latasha Daniels. If you made it this far, thank you from the bottom of my heart. Thank you for being here with me. If you want more stories like this, don't forget to subscribe. Until next time, stay safe. I'll see you in the next one. That wraps up this episode of Sleuthy Stories. Thanks for joining me as we uncover the twists and turns of real-life cases. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have a moment, please leave a rating. It really helps more true crime fans find us. Want to see the visuals that go with today's case? You can find the full video version on my YouTube channel, Sleuthy Lucy. Check the link in the description. I'll be back soon with another case. But until then, keep your wits sharp and your curiosity sharper.